This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast with host Ben Morse. Episode 5, 1965, Part 1, with Nick Duke.
Hey everybody, welcome once again to another spectacular, amazing web of edition of Marvel Age Masterclass. My name is Ben Morse. I used to be the editorial director of digital media over at Marvel Entertainment for 10 years. Now, I have made my way out to the desert. I am teaching at UNLV. I'm sitting in my backyard here in beautiful Las Vegas, Nevada, entertainment capital of the world. Learning how to pronounce the state right, getting yelled at by my wife and her brother. But yeah, I'm here to talk once again about Marvel Comics, which I love to do. And I love to do that with my friends. And one of my good friends is here tonight, none other than one half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and that would be Nick Duke. Nick, would you call yourself the leader of the Sarcastic Four?
I guess that I've kind of naturally fallen into that, or not naturally, accidentally fallen into that role, I guess you could say.
Nah,
and much like Reed Richards, I am the least interesting member of the Sarcastic Four.
No.
So there
come
you
on,
go.
Man. You don't have the little gray temples or anything like that.
Oh, I want the gray temple so bad, but
no,
more,
that
but
was,
more,
that's the worst.
But more as an homage to early 90s Hal Jordan than an homage to Reed Richards.
I just remember in the 90s, I was like, that to me is the sign that I can't like a character when it was Mr. Fantastic, Doctor Strange, and Green Lantern Hal Jordan. I love Hal now.
Right.
Do I? I don't know if I do. We'll talk about
that. Oh, come on now. No, don't tell me you're a Kyle guy. Come on.
No, we had this discussion. I told you, I'm more of a Guy Gardner guy.
Okay, then all is forgiven, sir. All is
yeah,
well.
Yeah. No, I mean, Kyle was not my Green Lantern growing up.
Right.
But he was Green Lantern when I started getting into DC.
Right.
And I guess, like, generationally, he would be my Green Lantern in the same sense that, like, I saw Wally West as the Flash. But, I mean, Wally was the Flash since, like, what, 86 or 87?
Right.
So that's a little different. No, I just always, when Hal came back and the way Geoff Johns wrote him initially, mm-hmm. before he kind of settled into him, I was like, oh, man, he's too much of a dick.
Yeah.
Like, he's too much just of, like, a jock. Meathead mm-hmm. pilot guy. I didn't care for him.
Right.
But as he kind of settled and became more well-rounded, yeah, I think, you know, he's a great character. And I think he plays very well off some of the other characters. But are you a purely Hal guy, or are you, like, split?
I would say I'm probably, like, 60% Hal, 35% Guy and like 5% yeah. John, and I have nothing at all for Kyle Rayner.
You got no love for Kyle
Rayner. No love for Kyle Rayner. Like, the only two characters I've ever read like every issue of in their publishing history are Thor and Green Lantern. And that 90s Kyle Rayner stuff to me, man, is just a slog because, like, it takes away everything interesting about Green Lantern. To me, what's interesting about Green Lantern is the core concept and, like, the idea of trying to distinguish yourself among this core of thousands. And when you distill it down to one guy, that era, like, I know there are a lot of people who are super passionate about it, but to me, it's not what I read Green Lantern for. So
makes sense, man. No, the first person I think of when I think of Kyle Rayner is I always think of Judd Winnick.
And not Ron Mars, huh?
No, I don't think of Ron Mars because I really like, I know Ron, and every time I used to see him, I used to say, like, hey man, have you ruined anyone's childhood lately? just because of the way he torched Hal Jordan fans' things. No, I always think of Judd because Ron was writing Kyle Rayner when I was kind of getting out of comics,
mm-hmm.
and Judd was writing Kyle Rayner as I was getting back into comics.
Gotcha.
I don't know. I associate Kyle Rayner with such a, like, MTV.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, jean shorts. Like, mm-hmm. just that kind of cool dude who's not necessarily that cool. And to me, that is, you know, that's Judd Winnick. He was on The Real World. He was, like, he's a sweetheart of a guy. But he was, like, you know, he was kind of like the nerd on The Real World. And I'm like, that's who Kyle Rayner is. I was
right.
like, that was the perfect writer for him. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I always have this weird attachment to the White Templed era of Hal Jordan, because like I read it after the fact. I wasn't reading comics in the 90s, and when you go back and read it with this whole new context, you realize that like in the 90s, he was the only character in the DC universe, at least from the classic character standpoint, that was actually being allowed to age. Like Bruce and Clark aren't really aging. You know, Dick and Wally are aging, but Hal is the one guy who's like, you're getting the impression that he's actually becoming the elder statesman of the DC universe, and that's a really cool. Really cool angle to take on him, especially during that time.
It's a neat angle. It's a neat idea. You definitely nailed it on the head, because I was a kid during the 90s.
Right.
So to me, I was like, oh, this is an older guy. I don't care about him. The same way, to circle back, because this is, of course, the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast, where you get all your Green Lantern opinions.
Yep.
No, it was the same way Reed Richards was an old guy and Doctor Strange was an old guy. And I'm like, I'm a kid. I don't relate to these guys. It's true. Or even like, you know, Spider-Man's married. I don't relate to him.
Don't get me started on the Spider-Man marriage thing, because I could go for hours.
Yeah, we won't get started on that. We'll cover it, because we'll get to that eventually, hopefully.
At some point, many years from now.
I grew up with married Spider-Man.
Right.
So I was kind of like, that's just, to me, that's his normal. He's married. He's a married guy. But I'm not going to lie. I did, like, when they unmarried him, I get why they did it, because I did, like, always see him as being like, oh, he's older than me. Like, he's not, I can't relate to him. I don't dislike him as a character, but I'm like, I'm not married to a supermodel.
Right.
so I can't, he's not very relatable. But yeah, that's a discussion for another time.
Absolutely.
Dude, this is a double honor to be podcasting with you. Not only are you the leader of the Sarcastic Four, but you rarely do two-man podcasts without Greg. So this has got to feel just...
God, yeah, I didn't even think about that until you said that. I'm trying to think of the last one I did without Greg.
No.
A two-man? I don't know that I ever have for Place to Be Nation. I've done some three-mans with guest appearances on Sellers Points or for the main Place to Be Nation Mothershop.
We did a three-man like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, you know, I'm trying to think of guest spots that I've done, and I guess you're right. I don't know that I've done another one. I mean, maybe somebody will bring one up at some point and make me sound like an idiot, but I can't think of one.
No one's gonna make you sound like an idiot but you, buddy. all right, so you guys had a great episode about a week ago. You guys have now split, as I did, into the part one and part two.
Yep.
Of doing Marvel Age, because we're getting to some pretty dense years where it's hard to cover 1 year in one episode. So tonight we talk about 1965, part one. And that, oh man, a bird just came into my yard. There we go.
I promise not to call you out every time a bird comes by.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Todd was, every time there was this noise, but this bird was like spiraling down towards me. I was like,
kamikaze style.
Yeah, I was like, is this prick going to die, like, in my lap? Like, oh, my God. Anyways, you guys got to hear here on the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast, where we get to hear all about Green Lantern and dead birds. So, 1965, you guys covered three very important comics. We're going to get into those tonight. Initial thoughts on 65. Did I say 64 a second ago?
No, you said 65.
Oh, man. All right, got to just keep rolling. So, 65, let's get your initial impressions of the year, having covered it on Marvel Age. What did you think? What were the big takeaways? What was going on in 65 that wasn't necessarily happening in 63 or 64?
Particularly, and I think you heard this on the episode, we talked about it a lot, the X-Men in particular are finding their footing and starting to tell, you know, stories that very early on in their tenure are iconic, man. I mean, that whole element of being something of a reflection of the times, you know, in society in 65 is right there. And as I discussed on the episode, I think there's a little bit of a narrative surrounding the X-Men that X-Men as we know them didn't really take off until Giant Size X-Men number one.
Yeah.
And reading these early books is just proving that's not true to me. Like, I think the foundation of what the X-Men would become in terms of a societal allegory are right there by 1965. I mean, you see it with the Sentinel story for sure. So to me, I was most taken with the X-Men in the biggest, baddest way. I thought they were the clear standouts, at least of the first part of the year, for what we covered in the episode.
Yeah, and I want to save them for last.
Okay.
We'll circle back to them at the end. I think on a more macro level, I think everything you said is correct, 100%. I'm actually looking forward to digging into the idea of the X-Men being the X-Men a lot earlier than people thought they were. And not even like, I think, you know, it's not even just the Giant Size X-Men number one. I think people say, like, oh, they didn't become the X-Men until, like, Roy Thomas, Neil Adams.
Mm-hmm.
at the earliest.
Right.
Like, they think those, not only that, it's like they didn't become the X-Men until the giant size X-Men, and there weren't any good stories before Roy Thomas and Neil Adams, I think, are the two narratives that you guys are disproving about X-Men. And we'll circle back to them. But the more macro thing I think is going on in 65 is you've got Stan, Jack, and Steve have been the big three-man kind of triumvirate running this universe. And what you're starting to see in 65, before it was just like, you know, they're all working on as many things as they can. Kirby's drawing 25 titles at a time. They're really just throwing stuff and seeing it sticks. I think Kirby in particular, in 65, you're starting to see him kind of cherry pick mm-hmm. his favorites. And we see it with X-Men. We start to see Kirby step away from certain projects so he can really focus on the stuff that he loves. Obviously, we're going to talk about Fantastic Four, where Kirby was putting a lot of his energy into. But I think you see with books like X-Men, Kirby's not as interested. He turns them over to other people. Mm-hmm. And as a result, Stan takes more ownership over some of these books. Because Fantastic Four is always going to be a Stan and Jack collaboration. You know, you can mm-hmm. argue for days about who contributed more, who contributed where, what the style of scripting was, etc. But I think as we saw with these years, you started to see X-Men become very much a Stan Lee creation.
Yes.
He was very much influenced. And I think to your point, we saw a lot more socially relevant stuff. Mm-hmm. Not that Kirby was opposed to that, but I think for whatever reason, this was just where Stan was at. Stan was a guy who, you know, toured college campuses and was always like very in touch with what was going on socially. And, you know, Jack was an older guy. He was a family man. He was a blue-collar guy. And I don't think he was necessarily tapping into that stuff. He would later, ironically enough, and he would do it greatly. And then you got Ditko, who we're not going to talk about in this episode because you guys didn't read any Ditko stuff. But I think we should kind of follow him as well, seeing, like, mm-hmm. is he doing the same thing as Kirby where he starts to pull away? You will eventually see him pull away from one thing in favor of another. But as far as this goes, I mean, yeah, I think it's just, it's interesting to see the contrast between a Stan and Jack who are into the third or fourth year of their collaboration mm-hmm. and then Stan on his own. And then eventually we'll get to see Jack on his own. That's a ways down the line. Mm-hmm. But it's always just interesting to see what these guys do when they're not necessarily working the other.
Right, right. And that especially happens for Stan, not just on X-Men, but Daredevil as well. Which, I mean, you've touched on a little bit in some of the Masterclass episodes. Something of a revolving door of creators early on. They haven't really nailed down who they want to work on that book, or honestly, what they want the book to be. Because from issue to issue, it has this very, almost like, scattershot feel, because there's no real consistency in terms of tone or pacing for that book so far.
I think, honestly, with Daredevil, and I said it last time, but I'll kind of, I think it crystallized here even more, is that Stan had some cool ideas with Daredevil, like, mm-hmm. I want him to be a lawyer, I want him to be blind, but I just don't think he had a fully realized character for him. And I don't think anyone would fully realize Daredevil in the kind of initial run of Marvel Universe. And that might, you know, sound like sacrilege to some who really love classic Daredevil stories, whether it's the original Stan stuff, whether it's the Denny O'Neil 1970s stuff. But I think, you know, I think it took a while for Daredevil to break out and kind of become his own man and kind of be different than Spider-Man, be different than the other street-level heroes. And a lot of what made Daredevil work eventually, and I don't want to jump too far ahead here, but was, I think you can see it early on, because Daredevil works best when he's rooted in tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing about early Daredevil should have been, you know, the fact that he comes from this tragic story of his father dying. But we talked about it, how Matt Murdock moves past that so quickly, and he's joking, and he's making quips, and he's doing all this stuff. He didn't really stick with the death of his father. Eventually, creators would circle back around to the idea that Daredevil is at his best when his life is at its worst,
mm-hmm.
when just terrible stuff is happening to this guy. And I think initially, it's interesting in 65, because this is the year we see him get kind of a push.
Yeah.
Then the fact that he fights Namor, so we'll just start with Daredevil here.
Okay, sure.
You know, he's kind of the easiest place to start, because he's the guy who has both the least and the most happening at the same time. He's getting kind of a push.
Right.
He fights Namor in a great issue. That's actually one of my favorite early Daredevil issues.
Oh, absolutely.
Simply because to this point in the Marvel Universe, we've only seen Namor really take on those that are his equals.
Mm-hmm.
Or similar. Like, you know, he's fought the Thing. They're about the same strength level. He fought the Human Torch back in the Golden Age. Both of them were heavily powered individuals. With Daredevil, it really is a David and Goliath story. And it's one of the... We've talked about how that worked with Hulk Thing, with Thing in the underdog role made it so much more appealing.
Yep.
This is that taken to three levels up.
Yeah.
Like, Daredevil has no business fighting Namor.
Yeah.
And you would see it, there's, in the 80s, there's a classic Daredevil issue where he fights the Hulk. It's a Frank Miller drawn issue, and it's fantastic. But I think this was kind of the prototype for that. This was kind of, you're starting to see something. So, as I just said in my whole spiel, and I'll cut it short in a sec so you can talk, but Daredevil, you know, he works when he's a hard luck hero.
Mm-hmm.
He works when the things are not in his favor. We don't necessarily want to see him out there beating up guys who are so far beneath him. We want to see Daredevil punching up and trying to survive against adversity. And I think with this Namor issue, it was the first time anyone really hit on a major factor of what makes Daredevil work.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, like you said, early on in his tenure, Daredevil was spending so much time running around and joking that it's difficult at times to really distinguish him, you know, personality-wise from Spider-Man. They read like very similar characters, and the stories are laid out in similar fashions. They both have more narrow scopes. But here with this Namor issue, very early on, there's an impression that Matt kind of realizes, you know, what he's up against, and that joking mentality is kind of put off to the side, and you start to see a Matt, like you said, that is fighting from underneath, is having to be more focused and driven, and it kind of starts to reveal what that character would become down the road. And, you know, from an art standpoint, one of the better drawn issues of 1965, I mean, the action scenes are outstanding. I mean, top to bottom, Daredevil 7 is one of the stronger issues we've read, and that's especially, you know, unusual considering, like we talked about earlier, Daredevil has been something of a inconsistent title here early on in his publishing history.
Well, it's I mean, you see that so often in comics, though, that sometimes the books that people are allowed to experiment on are where they really get to shine. Don't get me wrong, some of the headliner books, you know, obviously, Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, and the like do well, but when you get to see artists kind of come in and put their own take, I think the sense was Daredevil was not Spider-Man, so it was okay to take some chances on him artistically. Ultimately, it's what would, again, make the character successful in the 80s, was that they had nothing to lose. This was not one of their A-level characters, and honestly, that's what made him work again in the late 90s when Marvel Knights started. The idea being that, well, Daredevil's not Spider-Man. Daredevil's not even Hulk or Iron Man. We can do whatever we want with Daredevil. You know, he's not a sacred cow. And just the idea that you could kind of, you could mess around with Daredevil. You could do some different things. Now, they weren't doing that to this degree yet, but I would say guys like Wally Wood getting to come in and kind of draw their own take, they weren't living in the shadow of Kirby or Ditko because Daredevil, his definitive look, even seen by the fact that how quickly he changes costumes is, you know, he does not have a definitive, he has to look like this template early on. It takes him a while to kind of find his footing with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one thing we've touched on, you know, several times throughout this entire project is some of these costume designs are springing fully formed from the minds of Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko or whoever, and others are more of works in progress. And here with Daredevil is a perfect example of a work in progress. But, you know, while the yellow suit, I know it has its nostalgia value for some out there who enjoy the look or whatever, but that red suit that they get to here by issue 7, just a classic look, and they figured it out pretty quickly, but, you know, it was an example of something they had to work on and had to refine and get, you know, kind of go back to the drawing board a couple of times before they really nailed down what it needed to be.
It's just so distinct from the other costumes of the era, whether you're looking at, I mean, I guess you could look over at DC and say something like, you know, the Flash has the all red costume.
But even with the Flash, I've always viewed the Daredevil costume, even here in these early issues, as being a little bit of a darker, you know, a scarlet almost that's very, very dark and lends itself to a more street level crime focused sensibility.
Right. With Flash, you've got the bright red with yellow highlights. With Daredevil, like you said, you really have the darker red where the secondary color would be black.
Mm-hmm.
And it does set him up, like, even to the point where, like, you have Batman, you know, who's still in the blue and gray over on the other side. And Daredevil really does become that first serious crime character. And I think it's kind of, you know, it's helped identify him throughout the years as being like, this is the serious Marvel character. Like, of the classic Marvel characters from the 60s, this is the guy who he's an adult.
Mm-hmm.
He deals with serious crime. And if you mess with him, you're going to get messed up, basically. Like, you know, it's not like fighting Spider-Man, he's going to tie you up and leave a note. The idea is eventually, like, Daredevil would get there. Here, in these early issues, even though visually he's starting to look like that, he's still very much, in a character sense, kind of Spidey's older brother.
Right.
But they're starting to get there.
Yeah.
Like, we're starting to get the hints of Daredevil. The interesting thing for us, Nick, and you, like you said, you already read a lot of Daredevil. Where did you stop reading Daredevil in your reread before?
Oh, let's see. So I got through, I'm trying to remember, when did Stan leave the book? Because I read up to that point. He was on it for a while, and I read all...
He was on it a lot longer than people realize.
Yeah, I want to say I got up to like 70 issues, something like that. That sounds right.
I think he was still there into 70 issues.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing for us to track with Daredevil, and, you know, with a lot of these characters, X-Men, etc., is... So we've said now, Daredevil has the building blocks of what eventually made him a good character. It's going to be interesting to see what he spends the next couple decades doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know he doesn't break out big until the 80s.
Until Frank Miller,
so the until Frank Miller. So the question is, what was filling the pages of Daredevil? Because the book didn't get canceled.
Mm-hmm.
It was an ongoing book through the rest of the 60s on through the 70s. So I think it's going to be very interesting to kind of, you know, everyone maybe has read the first few issues of Daredevil out of curiosity. But I think when we start getting into the stuff you covered already, and then even more so the post-Stan Lee run on Daredevil, it's going to get really interesting, because I think that's a blind spot for a lot. No pun intended. I think that's a blind spot for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's definitely a blind spot for me. I mean, honestly, with the exception of some, you know, the Kevin Smith run and a little bit of the Brubaker stuff, Daredevil in general is a blind spot for me. You know, he's a character that everything I've ever read of him, I've really enjoyed, and yet I just haven't had the time or the, you know, ability to go out and check out the other stuff. I've never read the Frank Miller stuff. Never read any of it. And I can't wait to get there. Never read any of the Bill Sienkiewicz Elektra stuff, which is like high on my list of need to read. But, you know, it's just...
And you've never read the Bendis stuff.
That's the biggest thing for me. I'm like one of the biggest Bendis fans on the planet.
I know you love Bendis.
And I've never read any Bendis Daredevil. I've read all his Jessica Jones. Actually, I take that back. I read, as part of like a Jessica Jones reading chronology, the issues
of Daredevil where she showed up.
The issues where she showed up, yep. And they were like just random, intermittent, and so I didn't get any, like, you know, glimpse of the larger plot or how it all tied together. I was just reading her side appearances.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful thing, and for me, I know you love Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yep.
And one of the cool things about Bendis' Daredevil was reading it sort of, and you can still do this, like just keep Ultimate Spider-Man in mind when you're reading it and just kind of reconcile that it's the same guy.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you already have to do to an extent when you're reading like Alias and stuff like that. But Daredevil is more like, if we're talking about how Spider-Man and Daredevil have to be different to work, maybe no one got that better than Bendis in the 2000s, because he was able to write Spider-Man and Daredevil simultaneously and make them so different and make them in many ways different sides of the same coin,
right?
And really, really seize up on that. So anyways, we've got a lot of good Daredevil to come, but I do think we're probably gonna have to get through some really bad Daredevil before that, so we should probably steel ourselves for that.
Yeah, I gotta say, I mean, the other guys on the podcast could not give me a satisfactory explanation. As someone who's never appreciated the character or understood him, and now since you've worked at Marvel, can you please attempt to explain Stiltman to me and why he's a threat?
Stiltman.
Because that was our other issue of Daredevil for this reading list, was the debut of Stiltman.
Look, there are some characters who are great villains for the writers to come up with. And then there are some characters who artists just think, wouldn't this be fun to draw?
Okay.
Stiltman, I think, falls into the camp of the latter. Who was the artist on the Stiltman issue?
Oh, that's a great question. I should have that information at my fingertips, and I don't. Because, you know, it's not like most of the other titles where you can just call it out, because right, Daredevil was changing so much.
So
I'm going to look that up.
Yeah, well, you look it up. I'm going to speculate on the fact that even though he didn't necessarily, if he did draw this issue of Daredevil, great. But I know this was around the time that John Romita was kind of, along with Kirby, very influential on a lot of the art that was going on at Marvel. So I wonder if Stiltman was a Kirby idea or a Romita idea. He strikes me as being a villain who someone thought, oh, that would look really cool. And to be fair, like that first cover where Stiltman's fighting Daredevil, it's interesting. It grabs your attention, you know? It's a good gimmick in the sense that it's eye-grabbing. But then in the sense, like, how is this guy a sustainable villain? I don't think anyone was thinking that.
Yeah.
I think they were literally thinking, like, oh, it'd be a cool visual for Daredevil to be fighting this guy who is, you know, stories above him and has this crazy look, and that'll be kind of psychedelic and weird. And I think that was the extent of the thinking on Stiltman. I know that Mark Waid loves him. I know that Mark Waid loves Stiltman.
Yeah, I haven't read any of the Waid stuff, but Russell was telling me that he kind of used him as a recurring, you know, he would pop up from time to time in the pages of Waid's Daredevil.
Mark has a very well-known kind of affinity for the crazier Silver Age stuff.
Right.
So I think he takes pride in trying to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he takes a lot of pride. This is like a Mark Waid, Geoff Johns thing that I think Mark, because I always look at Mark as kind of the mentor of Geoff Johns, because Geoff followed him on Flash. And I just think they have a lot of similar sensibilities.
Right.
And I think they both love reclaiming goofy villains from the 60s and 70s and making them work.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like 90% of Geoff's Flash run.
And his Green Lantern run, honestly.
And his Green Lantern run. The difference is there wasn't as many good Green Lantern villains to kind of reclaim.
Mm-hmm.
I think Flash had a better rogues gallery, but that's neither here nor there. But with Mark, I think he loves doing the same thing. He loves taking villains and trying to gear them up. I don't know if you ever read Underworld Unleashed.
No.
All right, that's a Mark Waid, Howard Porter miniseries from the mid-90s.
Okay.
It introduced, again, this is Marvel Age Masterclass, where we talk more DC Comics than any other podcast you're going to listen to. But Underworld Unleashed was a miniseries in the mid-90s from Mark Waid and Howard Porter that it was before Howard Porter did JLA, and it was, the idea was they created the character of Neron, however that's pronounced, and basically juiced up all of the DC villains. Like, the deal was they all made a deal with Neron, a deal with the devil, and they all got, like, enhanced powers because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, it's a good story because Mark Waid's writing it and Howard Porter's drawing it, but the stuff they do to these villains, and Mark admits as much in the foreword to the collected edition that he wrote years later, it's so 90s. Like, they just do the most 90s things to all of these villains, and they just make them all more violent, and they're all more like, you know, the girls are all more sexy, and the guys are all more cutthroat. It's just, anyways. So Mark Waid has a history of trying to make bad villains work, and I think Stiltman is the apex of that example, if that answered your question at all.
Yeah, it did a little bit. I just remember, like, and you might remember this, I don't know, in the wake of the Affleck movie, you know, they were talking about making a Daredevil video game that eventually got scrapped. Right. And I remember reading an article in one of the gaming magazines about it, and they were making a big deal out of the fact that Stiltman was going to be one of the featured villains. And so, being very, like, new in my comics fandom, I went and looked up Stiltman, and I was like, what the is this? And so I've always had this weird response to him.
But doesn't he sound like the type of villain who, if you were a video game developer, you'd be like, oh, cool, what a great villain.
Yeah, because then you scale the buildings and stuff.
Yeah, trying to climb him and trying to get up to the top and all this stuff. Like, that's a video game designer's dream.
There you go. That's a good point.
Yeah, but I think, you know, comics-wise, yeah, he's Just I stick to my original explanation, was that he was a cool sight gag that some artist came up with.
Wally Wood, by the way, drew that issue.
It was Wally Wood. Wally Wood drew that as well. Okay, so maybe Wally Wood came up with it. Maybe Kirby. Maybe Romita. I think someone thought this will make a cool visual. Mm-hmm. And as I've talked about a couple of times on Masterclass, these guys were not necessarily, you know, planning for the future. They were not mm-hmm. Jonathan Hickman. They weren't. they weren't plotting 10 years at a time. They were just thinking, well, what's going to work this month? You know, what's, I think it was very much so that there was a mentality from Martin Goodman mm-hmm. that went back to, you know, the 40s and 50s in comics, with that idea that, like, well, what's going to get people's attention this month? Mm-hmm. And that kind of spills over to, you know, the anthology titles, and what's the weirdest thing we can put on the cover of Journey into Mystery
right.
this month to get someone's attention, to get them to read the story, even if the story within has nothing to do with that. I think that mentality was alive and well in the creation of Stiltman.
Gotcha. So yeah. I think we've so talked Daredevil to death. What about
we'll talk Daredevil to death? Hopefully, you know, he'll be back next. That's an interesting question too. Is that I wonder how long Daredevil's going to stay on the reading list, because I don't know how many important Daredevil issues there are.
God. I just looked. No Daredevil on the list for 66, but he's back in 67. So,
all right. Well, we'll look forward to that. Let's jump over to, of course, Daredevil made a guest appearance
mm-hmm.
in the way of a segue. He does appear in the pages of Fantastic Four. Yeah. Now, Fantastic Four at this point, hitting on all cylinders,
mm-hmm.
kind of cranking out concepts month after month. There's a couple things going on in Fantastic Four at this time. Now, number one, you have, of course, we'll talk about the wedding of Reed Richards and Sue Storm, which, again, one of my favorite stories of the era. Just so big, so grand. Every guest star, every villain. Kirby at his best, Lee at his best. Just doing great stuff. The issues surrounding it, kind of forgettable in the sense that it was just, well, we'll talk about them, but I don't think they're necessarily the best stuff. But then, towards the end of 65 and really hitting 66, Kirby and Lee kind of hit a stretch of really, really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe some of their best Fantastic Four work, which we'll get to discuss more next episode. But let's talk about, as you guys did, the Frightful Four.
Okay.
The bad guy opposite numbers of the Fantastic Four,
mm-hmm.
Led by the Wingless Wizard. Who, to me, is a fairly uninteresting character
mm-hmm.
in the sense that I think his selling point is supposed to be that he's like Reed Richards' intellectual mm-hmm. rival
mm-hmm.
and that he wants to prove that he's smarter than Reed, but we already have that.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
We already have Dr. Doom. Okay. Like,
with a much more interesting like visual look and character motivation.
Exactly. So the idea of bringing another smart guy into the book, there was no way he wasn't going to be seen as second rate.
Right.
He just wasn't a top tier villain. And I think maybe they try to balance that out by giving him a team.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't know, it just didn't work. It wouldn't be until years later, decades later, that the aforementioned Jonathan Hickman came on the book and actually did something interesting with the Wizard,
mm-hmm.
which was giving him a young clone. Which was the most interesting thing probably ever done to a Wizard. But to this point, the interesting thing is he actually starts out, I don't think you guys covered this, he started out as a Human Torch villain in Strange Tales.
I was not aware of that. Okay.
Yeah, he did not make his first appearance in Fantastic Four. He had shown up in Strange Tales as a Human Torch villain. And there's something to that, because there you almost have Human Torch fighting an evil version of his brother-in-law
mm-hmm.
because he's fighting a smart guy. Human Torch versus smart guy kind of makes sense, but I think there was temptation on Stan's part of, I want to match this guy up against Reed Richards. And if I'm going to make an evil Fantastic Four, which seems like a slam dunk, I'm going to make this guy, you know, the evil Reed Richards, because they couldn't make Doom the leader of the Frightful Four. That just wouldn't work. Doom,
no.
You know, he works alone. He doesn't work with other people. So in that sense, I can kind of, as I'm talking it through, see the logic of what Stan did in making the Wizard leader of the Frightful Four. But I think right off the bat, it just labels them as kind of a second-rate team.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I think maybe not having Doom there is because Doom's above it. Like, he doesn't really need the rub, so to speak, from a from an evil team-up. At least not one that consists of, you know, Sandman, who's a Spider-Man villain, and Paste Pot Pete, who thankfully they got around to renaming him pretty quickly after the debut of the Frightful Four. But at least this does give us Medusa. And that's one thing that we talked a little bit about on the episode was I was questioning whether or not the Medusa Inhumans reveal was pre-planned, and I don't think when she debuted it was. I don't know what makes me think that. Just something about reading it. There's no indication of it. There's no hint of it. She's just kind of off on this island doing her own thing. You get the impression she's been there a while, and you know the Inhuman royal family isn't exactly like you know hot on her heels or anything. So it at least gave us that. I think that's the best thing we can say about it is that it gave us you know. It cracked the door open for the Inhumans epic that was to come because we see that at the end of 65, and like you said earlier, it stretches all the way into 1966. And the argument can be made it's really perhaps Stan and Jack's first real long form story on Fantastic Four.
Yeah, and I'm interested in getting more into Inhumans as we get into 66. I like some of the discussion you guys had of, believe me, I have plenty of stories about humans as X-Men replacements and how I felt about that. We'll get there.
Can't wait.
But I tend to agree with you, and I have never heard from any historian or any editor in the know the definitive take on Medusa and whether or not what, you know, kind of the chicken or the egg argument with Medusa and the Inhumans. I tend to side with you. I tend to think that for the reason that I think between the Frightful Four issues and the Inhumans issues, she is written so drastically different.
Right.
That to me, it's a matter of Leon Kirby creating this character as a villain, just as a pure villain, who would add to the Frightful Four, because obviously you need to have a female member of the Frightful Four, because they're the opposite members of the Fantastic Four. I think they found a visually appealing character because that is kind of like when you're thinking like we talked about Stiltman earlier being a cool visual, like Medusa is a great visual.
Yes,
like the living hair, like just really cool, and especially in Kirby's hands, just so much you could do with that. But as far as her character in those initial Frightful Four issues, she's pretty much a blank slate. She's just like the normal kind of femme fatale Black Widow-esque villain.
Which I think kind of works, you know, in support of the theory that they just kind of made that change on the fly. I mean, I think that you had a visually distinctive character who was really interesting, and it was clear that Jack probably loved drawing her and kind of went, and Stan was looking at her going, okay, the Frightful Four thing didn't hit the way we thought it would, but what can we do with her instead? And kind of stumbled into the Inhumans concept, which, you know, remove all the modern day context from that. The Inhumans were a pretty classic Fantastic Four concept for years, for decades, before we got into the whole X-Men replacement era.
You got to take yourself out, and we will talk to Inhumans a little bit here. You got to take yourself out of the modern context, the idea of that, you know, the Inhumans are this second-rate X-Men or this failed TV show or anything else. You have to look at them like in a purely, think if you were seeing these for the first time in the 60s, how cool these characters were. And we can start with Medusa. Just, again, there was nothing like her out there. Like, this power was so unique. Female characters who had some agency in 1965 were not plentiful. I talked last episode with Todd kind of about how Scarlet Witch was a quantum leap forward from the other female characters simply because she was conflicted. So she had a second dimension to her. Medusa was actually, as she would kind of evolve, again, I said she started out more on the Black side than the Scarlet Witch side, being kind of a rote female villain. But as she developed over the course of these few issues, even, she becomes a really nuanced character. I think something that's really interesting that people seem to forget about is that there's like a little romance thing going on with her and the Torch, which is very weird considering what's to come. But that, to me, only goes, Nick, to further reinforce your theory that they're basically making up what they're doing with Medusa on the fly.
Yeah.
Cause I think they, you know, they're throwing stuff against the wall. Is she a villain? No. Is she in love with the Human Torch? No. What's working? What's not working? Okay, how can we make this work? And then by the time they get around to bringing in Gorgon, mm-hmm. Who's another, you know, just, again, visually, these characters, you can tell on Fantastic Four, some of the characters who are Stan's babies and some who are Kirby's babies. I think the Inhumans were very much Kirby's.
Yeah.
Just because of how visually impressive they were. I think Stan did a great job in terms of establishing, you know, cool characters, mm-hmm. the idea of this hidden city. But also, if you look at a lot of Kirby's later work, whether you're talking New Gods, Eternals, whatever, he seemed to really be enamored with this idea of the hidden race mm-hmm. within humanity that is somehow more
yeah.
than humanity. And I think, especially on Eternals, he would explore this again and again. So I think you see with Kirby, a lot of his favorite themes get echoed throughout his work throughout the decades. You see some of his Journey into Mystery come into play in New Gods. And again, you see some of Inhumans come into play in Eternals. But I think these were just visually amazing characters. Black Bolt, there's a reason that in his decades of existence, Black Bolt has never really changed his costume.
Right.
Because there's no need. The guy has a perfect costume.
Right.
Like, pretty much all the other Inhumans have been reimagined at some point, which I would argue don't try to improve on a classic Kirby design. but Black Bolt is just, you know, forever Black Bolt. I mean, come on, dude. Are you a Kiss fan at all?
A little bit. You know, I consider myself a casual Kiss fan.
So, Gene Simmons' costume mm-hmm. for the Demon is based on Black Bolt.
Really? Didn't know that.
If you ever look...
I knew he was a big Marvel fan with the legend of yeah. The blood and the ink and all that, but...
Right. No, but the... He has the, like, underarm wings that
okay.
Black Bolt has
okay.
On all his demon costumes, and that was directly from Black Bolt.
Very interesting. You
very
know,
cool little tidbit.
I think the Inhumans in general, and you know, circle back and kind of expand it back out to Fantastic Four as a whole, the Inhumans in general come along here in 65 where I think you're starting to see, you know, Jack has been great, but I think he's starting to become more... He's experimenting more. He's becoming yeah. more creative. He's doing different things. You will probably know the technical term for it, but mm-hmm. this art technique they introduce here where they're taking these black and white scientific photographs and mm-hmm. overlaying Jack's drawings on top of them for like some mm-hmm. of the shots of the Fantastic Four soaring through the cosmos and stuff. That is just yeah. mind-blowing stuff for 1965.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd call that technically Fumetti
mm-hmm.
or not. Fumetti being the idea of taking comic drawings and kind of imposing them on real world backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So I guess this might be an early example of that. But yeah, man, you're right. You hit the nail on the head. Kirby is doing incredible stuff in 65. And I think, again, this is why he's no longer drawing X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
This is why he's not going to be drawing Avengers for that much longer, is because I think he's saying, he's like, look, I have found what I love to do.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love to do is create stuff on Fantastic Four, because that's kind of, you got to remember that I think that we don't see really now is there's no, in modern day comics, and it hasn't, and it's been this way for decades, there is no central book of the Marvel Comics line, I would argue.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no flagship book, but that used to be a thing in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
was Fantastic Four was very much a flagship book of Marvel.
Right.
And if something was going to be introduced that was important, it was going to come out of Fantastic Four. And if a new character debuted, they were going to guest star in Fantastic Four to kind of prove their bona fides. You know what I mean?
Daredevil. I mean, in 65, for yeah. example.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, even like, you know, Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
what does he do in his first issue? Meets the Fantastic Four.
Right.
To establish that this guy is part of the Marvel Universe.
Right.
The Avengers and the X-Men both get legitimized when they cross over with Fantastic Four.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's an important book. So you've got Kirby on the one hand saying, well, I want to create stuff like the Inhumans and what would be to come, because the stuff that comes after the Inhumans is just as important, if not more so. But the Inhumans are, I would agree with you, they're his first, beyond the FF themselves, beyond Doom, beyond some of the kind of hit or miss villains. I mean, the Skrulls, Kree, there are some things that would stick around, Puppet Master, Mole Man.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are all fine, okay? but none of them are as enduring visually and mythologically as the idea of the Inhumans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's got all these cool ties to, like you said, mythological concepts. They're all visually distinctive from one another, because, I mean, you talk about the Skrulls or the Kree, cool concepts, but they all look the same. And here, it's essentially free reign for him to do all these wildly different character designs and action sequences in one concept. So it was, you know, Jack Kirby in general in 65 was just, he was taking his game to another level. He was doing different things. He was putting more on the page in terms of, you know, variety. And it's just incredible to see.
And I think, again, that ties directly back to the idea that he made the decision, whether it was with Stan or on his own, to say, like, look, I'm not going to draw every book and give, you know, 20% of my genius to each book. I want to fold it all back into Fantastic Four and one other book he'd stay on that we'll talk about in the second half of 65. But really, in a lot of ways, this is him pulling back to say, like, look, I want to draw Fantastic Four the best it can be.
Right.
And I want to really put my creative stamp on these characters and on these concepts that I'm going to introduce.
You know, you mentioned a little while ago, not to shift topics or anything, but like you mentioned a little bit ago how, you know, at this era in Marvel Comics, the Fantastic Four was without a doubt the flagship book of Marvel. So I have a little bit of a question I'd like to pose. If the flagship book of Marvel very early on in the foundation of the Marvel Universe is not afraid to have a wedding, why are the big two so afraid of it in 2017 and 18?
I just think, and that's a great way to transition to the wedding, I just think that, man, at the end of the day, I think Stan and Jack were just incredibly brave as creators. I think they, you know, it's easy to, it's two things. Number one, it's the bravery of Stan and Jack as creators. Two, it's the fact that you have to remember these characters had only been around for 4 years.
True.
So people weren't used to seeing them as single. Mm-hmm. Like, more people are used to Reed and Sue being married than them being apart. Like, it's just, it's a woven in part of continuity. It's just something we've all grown up with and understand. I think it's much easier to marry off new characters who you've just introduced.
Right.
Who don't have the history of a Spider-Man or a Batman or any of these. Yeah, right. or any of these other characters who, you know, to marry them fundamentally changes them.
Mm-hmm.
It alters the stories that fans have been reading for, you know, half a century.
Right.
Or however long. Like, you have a married Spider-Man and all of a sudden it's not the Spider-Man that these guys grew up with for 30 years. But with Reed and Sue, Stan and Jack, again, being creatively bold, said right away, like, 3-4 years into these characters' existence, we're going to marry them off. We're going to fundamentally change something about Fantastic Four. We are going to alter the status quo. And I think it's stuck in the sense that Fantastic Four is a book where you can make kind of big changes, if that makes sense, to this day. I mean, what other book has children, like children of the heroes characters, who have been as enduring as Franklin and Valeria?
None.
And who are actually, like, they're accepted, you know? They're not hated by fans. They're not like, oh, they're accepted as being a key part of Fantastic Four. And I think that's because early on, Stan and Jack said, this is a book that's going to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, just to throw it back to your initial point, a lot of the other books, and I think Stan tried to do that with all his books.
Mm-hmm.
Look at how quickly he moves Peter Parker through high school and into college.
Yeah.
Look at how quickly he ages Peter Parker up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a fear, and I'm not saying this at all as someone who worked at Marvel, as someone who had the inside track. This is purely my observation. I think there is a fear now that fans are used to characters being a certain way and doing the sort of wholesale big change that marrying them off causes.
Mm-hmm.
I think creators and editors and ads people and everyone else, marketing people, are afraid to do that if they don't know in the back of their minds, like, well, here's how I'm going to get out of it.
Right, right.
In
and that's
in 2 or 3 years.
That's the frustrating.
Like, they have to write an escape hatch. You
know? Right, and that's the frustrating part. It's like, one is suggesting that these marriages or proposed marriages would be, you know, always and forever and irrevocable. You know, to me, the wholesale shying away from it by both Marvel and DC is taking a tool out of the toolbox. Like, no one is saying you have to use a screwdriver in every situation, but there are stories that warrant it, and it would be interesting, and you can explore that dynamic, and once you've explored it and you come up with a satisfactory way to kind of reset things to the status quo, then by all means do it. But to say we're not going to go there as often as it feels like they do, I don't know, man. That's been something that's stuck in my craw for like a good 6-7 years now.
It's fair, man. And honestly, it was I know X-Men Gold with the wedding issue just came out, what was it, last week, 2 weeks ago?
2 weeks ago, yeah.
I was in the room when they made the decision to marry Gambit and Rogue. And it came from the X-Men editor basically saying, all right, so we're going to do a wedding with Kitty Pryde and Colossus. And some people in the room be like, no, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. Like, the kind of the attitude that you're portraying, just the idea that Kitty Pryde can never be married because she's everyone's teenage crush, and we don't want to, you know, age her into a married woman, which you can argue for or against or whatever. But someone said, and I forget who it was, and it's almost better that way because it can just be kind of an anonymous thing.
Right.
Someone said, well, if we're not going to deliver on a Kitty Pryde Colossus wedding, what if we marry off Gambit and Rogue? Because I think the sense was, they're like, we've told all the stories we're ever going to tell with Gambit and Rogue, and people always want them together.
Yep.
Like, they're just like, people accept them as a couple that is always supposed to be together, so why not explore the idea of them being married?
Yeah.
Because every time we've tried to split them up, people want them back together. So this is almost the perfect couple to do the exact thing you were saying that companies are afraid of. Because I don't think there is an escape hatch written into the Gambit and Rogue marriage. I think they're, for the foreseeable future, the plan is for them to be married. And I would compare it, weird as it sounds, because it sounds nothing alike, but the idea of Superman and Lois getting married in the 90s. I don't think the people who married off Superman and Lois in the 90s wrote it with any intention of it ever being undone. It was just understood that this was how it was going to be moving forward. And as we discussed a couple weeks ago on your podcast on Hard Traveling Fanboys, Superman being married and eventually having a kid is the best thing that ever happened to Superman.
Right.
Because it makes him different from all these other characters who, no, we can't marry them off. No, they can't have a kid. And it gives him something cool for people to latch onto.
Right, and I would argue for a character like Superman, it doesn't fundamentally change him the way it would, you know, the way it would a Batman, for example. But even with Batman, like, there's still some interesting story to be told there of him finding personal happiness and then losing it all because of a recession that he has. But again, we're once again talking DC on Marvel Age Masterclass.
It might be the signal that I need to start a DC podcast, but no. Getting back to Reed and Sue, again,
right.
I think what made them work so much was the idea that literally from the moment these characters were introduced, their love story was kind of rolling along, and it gave Stan and Jack the chance to, in the wedding issue, kind of pay off 4 years of subplot.
Yeah.
Because the soap opera subplot of Fantastic Four was always, you know, Reed and Sue, how are they going to work? You introduce elements like Namor, elements like, you know, Ben being kind of interested in Sue on and off for a few issues.
which they would play out to its ultimate conclusion in the Ultimate Universe.
Yeah, that would come back.
Yep.
But I don't know, just the idea that, like, you could... It was such a big culmination to a story. Like, it was like you'd been following these guys. And I think what I love about the wedding issue more than anything else is the fact that, if you think about it, they've been hyping up this event for the entirety of their run. Because Sue and Reed, whether they're engaged or not in the first issue of Fantastic Four, you get the sense like, oh, these are two people who are eventually going to get married.
Right.
Like they're set up as that couple.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so hyped up. I love the fact that I feel like the wedding issue, the annual of Fantastic Four, is an issue that lives up to the hype,
mm-hmm.
which is so rare in comics. And Stan and Jack, of course, had the advantage of the fact that they were doing this first before anyone else did.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, there weren't like a lot of wedding issues for them to have to try to top. Like I remember when Cyclops and Jean Grey got married in the 90s, and it was like, well, how is their wedding issue going to be better than this issue, the Fantastic Four wedding issue? And they did their best, but there's something about being first. And also, I just think the idea of the way the Marvel Universe was in 1965, where you could very easily have every character in mm-hmm. this issue, which they do,
mm-hmm.
And just like, and the fact that Kirby's going to draw all of them, and they're all going to get a page to do something fun, like the mm-hmm. fact that, you know, even like Hawkeye gets a moment to himself
yep.
In this thing. It's just like, this. I don't know if this will sound controversial or not, but I mean, the Fantastic Four wedding issue, in some ways, is the template for Avengers Infinity War, the movie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's the idea that we're going to bring all of our characters onto the same stage.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it didn't have the pathos of Infinity War. It wasn't as serious. There wasn't the stakes. I mean, as long as you're not Tim Cable. But it didn't have the stakes, but it definitely had the expansive cast and the idea that everybody has something to do. Right. But at the end of the day, it's still, you know, it's Reed and Sue's moment. With a little bit Ben and Johnny in the mix.
And that's the cool thing about it to me from a plot perspective is it's definitely built around building up to Reed and Sue's moment. But if you're actually tracking Doom's plot, Reed and Sue aren't necessarily integral and don't play a huge role in foiling Doom. So you get the impression that, like, you know, Ben and Johnny and all the disparate members of the Marvel Universe, their greatest gift to Reed and Sue is preventing their big day from being ruined. And so it's like all these other characters are taking these actions, so at the end you get that payoff for Reed and Sue, which I thought was really cool.
And kind of the cool idea is that even like in, and I agree, that is very cool. I think the idea that they, that Reed and Sue don't actually lift a hand to have things. It's very much in keeping with Fantastic Four, though. It's like they're, you know, they're a family and they're counting on the rest of their family. They have confidence in them that they're going to take care of this for them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of cool to think about. We've talked about Secret War before on this podcast as being kind of the ultimate Doom story. In many ways, this was the first ultimate Doom, because this was Doom versus the entire Marvel Universe.
Right.
Yes, he has other villains serving as his proxy,
mm-hmm.
but it really is everybody versus Doom. And it kind of places Doom on a certain level as what other villain could have done this, you know? Like, what other villain at this point in Marvel could have commanded all the other villains to fight every hero? And it just, in so many ways, it's the Fantastic Four I've talked about in past episodes about how it serves as the template of things that would come after. Fantastic Four itself is the template for the modern team comic.
Right.
Every team comic literally to this day, into 2018, owes something to Fantastic Four. Doom was the first, in my opinion, true fleshed out villain of the Silver Age. And I think a lot, if not all, villains, great villains, who have come since owe something to Doom. In that same sense, event comics, anything that's an event, whether it's a one-issue event or a 12-issue event, they started in many ways with this issue. This is the first story where you get the widespread guest stars, the crazy villain team-ups, the art going all out. And just, I think, in many ways, this was the template that set things up for what we're still seeing to this day as far as these big events that people either love or hate. But the only difference is, back then, everybody loved it. It was universally loved issue. Yes, you could say something like the first Amazing Spider-Man annual with him fighting the Sinister Six is in some ways an event. Granted. And some stuff done by DC, you know, the Earth 1, Earth 2 crossovers could be seen as the first like event crossover stories. But, I don't know, in sheer scope and just epic feel, I feel that this particular story is kind of the godfather, the grandfather of all event stories to come.
Yeah, and it's especially interesting because these Fantastic Four annuals, I mean, only three annuals in, have kind of become, you know, the early equivalent of what is now the big summer event for Marvel. Because these, I mean, Fantastic Four Annual 1 with Namor, or Annual 2 with the Doom story, these are huge, important stories that feel, they feel big, and they feel like something you would spend your entire year anticipating back then. I mean, it's remarkable the level of storytelling they're able to do in these 72 pagers.
And then, like I said, throw Amazing Spider-Man Annual number
one
absolutely. In there as well. Like, you really, Marvel's track record as far as these annuals, mm-hmm. and that's another thing to kind of watch as we're moving forward.
I am so excited to talk Journey into Mystery Annual number one on our next episode. So
yeah, I mean, that's another huge one. But like, it's going to be interesting to see where they start falling off,
mm-hmm.
and somewhat sad as well to see where they start falling off.
Yeah,
but we're gonna have to keep an eye on that. But I just think this is, to me, this is one of the, it's the purest distillation of what made the Marvel Universe so cool and so different mm-hmm. from anything else. It's all right here. It's in the same way when we talked about the Spider-Man annual being kind of, all right, here's everything you could love about Spider-Man mm-hmm. in one issue.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're picking it up and you have no intention of buying any other Spider-Man, like, you get it all. You get all the villains, you get all the Peter stuff, you get everything. With Fantastic Four, the wedding, you get, and it's cool about the Marvel Universe, the fact that these characters grow up and are real and have mm-hmm. real relationships and get married. Every hero, every villain, the fact that this is all taking place in the same city, you know? Just this interconnectivity. So all the things that made the Marvel Universe work in the early 60s, I think, are on display here. And it's so perfect that it's Stan and Jack doing it. And it's so perfect that they get the cameo. Because, like, without them, it's like this stuff doesn't happen. And just the stuff they're doing is so next level. I mean, again, we've talked plenty about DC on this particular episode. But this is why Marvel in 1965 was destroying, I don't have the financials in front of me, so I don't know if they were like leaps and bounds ahead of DC, but creatively,
right,
there's not even a question mm-hmm. that Marvel was, you know, destroying DC, and this issue is a perfect example why.
I agree with everything you just said.
Yeah, there it is. I would you know what, hold on a sec. Looked at my clock. Do we have time? All right. Let's talk quickly before we move on to X-Men. I want to make sure we have enough time left for X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
But real quick, just because he's become kind of the signature character of Marvel Age Masterclass, for better or worse, let's talk about Dr. Doom for one more second.
Okay.
And the thing I want to talk about, and I'll put specifically you, I'll let you talk, is that I love that in 1965, Dr. Doom is a nuanced and versatile enough villain that in the wedding issue, which is kind of a celebration of all things Marvel, and Doom kind of has to be not the most serious villain. Like, he's not really a serious threat in the wedding issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, he does come up with this crazy scheme, and he's going to, you know, turn all the villains against Reed and Sue's wedding. But he's so, like, he's just at his pissed, mm-hmm. wanting to ruin Reed Richards' best day.
Yep.
And just like it, you need him because you need a villain who has the caliber to pose this kind of threat. But I would argue that the other story that you guys read for this year, the one with the Daredevil guest star, mm-hmm. is a much more serious Doom appearance.
Yeah.
Like, in the same year, he's both an entertaining kind of like stock, like event, like we just need him for this event.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, there's a deeply personal Doom story. So again, I think it speaks to the versatility of the character and how complex he was.
Yeah, and you especially start to see, you know, what you've talked about, this personal rivalry for him becoming his central focus. Because that Daredevil story that you mentioned where he guest stars in FF 39 and 40, Doom at one point says, like, verbatim, I want to take over the world, but first I must destroy Reed Richards. And like,
exactly.
You get that he's stating nothing else I will ever do will matter to me until I destroy Reed Richards first. And so like, you start to see the depths of his obsession with this personal rivalry, and it's something that'll carry forward, I'm sure, you know, over the decades. But yeah, Doom, His appearance in the wedding issue, while you're right, it was mostly for entertainment's sake and it was kind of a silly plot, it would have felt so strange to have such a significant Fantastic Four event without Doom playing a role.
Not have Doom there, right.
Yeah, like, yeah, Doom had to be there in some way, shape, form, or fashion. Like, it just had to, it had to happen. So, between FF 39 and 40 and the Fantastic Four annual, I think you get a whole lot of Doom here in 65, and I think it just carries forward a lot of the things about his character that we've called out previously.
Yeah, no, I never get sick of talking about Dr. Doom. I think he's just one of the best characters in all of comics. Shame that he has never been fully realized on any other medium.
Well, you know, the hope is that eventually with him coming back to Marvel Studios proper at some point in the next few years, that we will be able to correct that.
Well, the video that is really, it's a gift, if all this, you know, Fox Marvel stuff works out, is that the ultimate gift, everyone's talking about the X-Men coming back, some people are talking about the Fantastic Four coming back. If I were Marvel Studios, if I was Kevin Feige, I would be more grateful that there is a villain I can use who's going to top Thanos, because that's what they, it's kind of tough to build everything up to Thanos, and then everyone else is going to seem like small potatoes in comparison. But if they get Dr. Doom right, you know, he can be the ultimate villain.
Let me tell you my ultimate fanboy hope for the Fox Disney merger is that in the third Homecoming film, Spider-Man has Kitty Pryde in his class, and we get the big screen adaptation of the ultimate Kitty Pryde and Peter Parker relationship.
I would absolutely love to see that.
I was such a mark for that.
I was a mark for it too. I loved it, and oh man, good stuff. But what a perfect transition talking about Kitty Pryde, who we will not talk about tonight because she's not going to be created for another 20 years or so. But let's get to the X-Men. We promised that we would come full circle and kind of talk about the X-Men. Of course, the stories you guys covered introduced two major threats to the X-Men that remain major threats to this day. And it's interesting because in these threats, you get two almost diametrically opposed villains. You get one villain who has such personal ties to the team and is purely motivated in the same way Doom is, by a personal grudge, and would become, I would argue, one of the more interestingly, despite the fact he's a very physical villain, would become a very emotional villain because of his emotional attachments to one specific character in X-Men. Whereas on the other side, you have the ultimate form of this is just business. And, you know, it's literally killer robots who do not have any personality. And they're just, you know, they're going to destroy mutants because they are programmed to destroy mutants. So what I'm talking about, of course, is first of all, the Juggernaut.
Yep.
Cain Marco, stepbrother of Professor X, and, you know, right there in the name of the character, his name is friggin' Cain. They weren't exactly subtle about what they were going for. And then after that, they introduce the Sentence. So let's talk first about Juggernaut. I thought, you know, it was interesting at this point in the strip to introduce a character who was tied historically to Professor X. Professor X, at this point, being kind of a mysterious character. We don't know a lot about him. We don't know a lot about his past. And it was interesting to see his childhood get explored a little bit and to find out that his childhood was pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, up to a point.
Yeah.
He was popular. He was good at sports. Like, you kind of just assume that they're like, oh, this poor bald guy in a wheelchair his life must have been terrible from the jump. But no, like, things were pretty good for Charles Xavier once upon a time.
I think the big thing about Xavier we see here, more so than his childhood, to me anyway, this is the first example of something that we're going to see over and over and over, you know, throughout the years, is that Charles Xavier is a character who you can't keep a secret from. Because he can read everybody's mind, but he is the king of keeping secrets from other people.
Right.
And so he has this very contentious relationship with his stepbrother that he has a pretty good feeling is going to come back to bite him at some point, and yet he never mentions it. And it's the first glimpse of, like, you know, for all his good guy persona, Charles Xavier is not really keeping his students on the up and up here.
No, it's interesting because, I mean, if you look at, and we'll get to it more with the Sentinels, the idea of the X-Men as being the metaphor for the civil rights movement and Xavier being the Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, that paints him as, oh, isn't he the ultimate good guy? He wants peace between the races. Like, what a moral, staunch, almost Gandhi-like figure.
Mm-hmm.
But because this is Marvel and the characters have feet of clay, and because, you know, Spider-Man might be this teenager we all love, but he was also an arrogant dick who got his uncle killed. And because, you know, all these characters have flaws, yes, Professor X might be the darkest of all the Silver Age Marvel characters. And I think that's something to speak to your narrative that you talked about earlier in the episode, the idea that so many things in the X-Men didn't come about until the 70s or 80s, and Chris Claremont created all of them, or, you know, the later writers did. Like, no, the idea of Professor X being kind of a shady jerk, like, that was there from the beginning. Like, he's always been this very dark character, and I think, you know, credit to Stan Lee for, again, inverting and flipping on its head a trope in comics. In the same way he took the teenage superhero, kind of the smiling, grinning, everything's great teenager, and produced Spider-Man and the X-Men, mm-hmm. these kids who, for everything, not everything in their world was perfect and all right, mm-hmm. and they were much more sullen. I think in the same way, you always had a mentor figure to these characters was always just this great, you know, the cool version of an adult, you know? The one you would want hanging out. You're a teenager, but you'd want to hang out with this guy. I'm thinking back to, like, this is a terrible example, but I'm thinking back to Teen Titans and Mr. Jupiter, who was their Silver Age mentor.
Right.
Who was just like, you know, benevolent, great guy who everyone loved. Mm-hmm. And that's the template for the mentor to the teen heroes. No, Xavier was, I used it once, I'll use it again, he was shady.
Yeah.
He had all this stuff going on, and he had, like, ulterior motives, and he had crazy secrets. And that's what makes him, to this day, a great character, because on the one hand, yes, he is the mutant figure striving for peace and wanting to do better, and he has this great dream of racial harmony, but yeah, he's also a jerk. And, like, he's also just not a good guy. And he's, like, you know, he's not morally above everybody else. So I don't know. I think Juggernaut's fine. He's a good character, great mm-hmm. visual, cool powers just in terms of being strong and unstoppable. But I think kind of our conversation thus far proved that to me the most interesting part of debuting Juggernaut was to give Xavier another added depth.
I agree. And I mean, also visually, it gave, you know, it brought something to the book in terms of a dynamic action sequence, again, you know, the matching the X-Men up against this never ending, you know, never ceasing ball of chaos, you know,
right.
Juggernaut as a character who is in constant motion, even if he's, you know, as we see in the issue, 35 feet under the ground, he's still moving forward. And so it's a cool, you know, it's a cool visual, concept for the X-Men to bounce up against, but you're right, from a character standpoint, it's all about Charles Xavier here.
I would say the thing that I'll give credit to Juggernaut for, and mm-hmm. I like Juggernaut, he's a great villain, he's a classic villain, but the thing that Juggernaut has going for him, you would say, is that of all the X-Men villains, he's probably the one that has, and I'll even include Magneto in this, he's probably the one who has broken out and become a Marvel Universe villain more than any of the other X-Men villains. Like, you've seen great Juggernaut,
Hulk.
Thor stories, Spider-Man, Hulk, Avengers, all these different characters. Like, he's just a cool concept because the idea of him being unstoppable, the minute you put him, like, maybe the best Juggernaut story of all time is that two-parter with Spider-Man, where Spider-Man has to figure out a way to beat him.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't reveal how he does it, because I hope that'll eventually be on our reading list someday. but, yeah, the Juggernaut, cool concept, and definitely goes far. You guys talked about it, and you talked about it more just now. I love the idea that he's perpetual motion.
Mm-hmm.
That's just another neat layer, the fact that he is literally always moving forward. And that's something I think they need to touch upon more. I mean, also, at the end of the day, though, I like Juggernaut is just an evil scumbag.
Yes.
Like, he's just the bad guy. I've I've never really been a fan of them attempting to do the Juggernaut babyface turn, which mm-hmm. has happened numerous times in mm-hmm. numerous different comics. Mm-hmm. Just give me Kane Marco as an unrepentant jerk.
Yeah.
Just a bully and just a bad guy.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you on that one. You know, we talked about a little bit in the issue, you know, some of the other guys were saying that the Juggernaut origin and his relationship with Xavier kind of makes him relatable or sympathetic in some way. And I didn't think so, man. I'm like, so his brother, you know, his brother-in-law was better than him at stuff, you know, or his stepbrother, excuse me. I mean, what you got to kind of learn to deal at a certain point and not be a giant douche, because that's what he is from their first encounter. Is he's being a complete bully to Charles Xavier. So no, I didn't find him sympathetic or relatable in the least. So
no, not at all. I don't think so. I'm with you. I mean, he's not a good guy. He's clearly like the bad brother. Yeah, just because he's ultimately what is the root of his problems is that he's jealous. He's jealous of Charles. But it's the same way, you know, that Doom is jealous of Reed. It's mm-hmm. the same way that all these characters are jealous of each other. It doesn't give you license to go out and be, you know, a supervillain.
Right.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you still got to, you know, kind of see it that way. But, yeah, Juggernaut's cool. We will see more of him across the Marvel Universe in the future. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, let's circle back to the very first thing we talked about when we started this episode, I believe, mm-hmm. if it wasn't Green Lantern. and that is this idea that the X-Men, which has become known for being a metaphor for social and civil rights, mm-hmm. Which some people would say the best X-Men stories are about the ideas of mutants as a minority, as mm-hmm. The other.
Mm-hmm.
And there is that sense that, oh yeah, but in the 60s, they were just a group of teen heroes, mm-hmm. and they weren't very popular, and they got canceled. And then they brought them back in the 70s, and they added the minority and the social stuff, and that made them interesting. That's simply not the case. I mean, what's the issue number of it's a trilogy of issues for the Sentinels. What's the first issue they show up in?
14 through 16.
So less than 2 years mm-hmm. in to the X-Men's history, if you can read this initial Sentinels story, which, by the way, I forget who talked about it. It might have been you. I apologize for not remembering who. But whoever said, you know, their entryway to the Sentinels was the Night of the Sentinels 2-parter on X-Men Animated. I'm right there.
That was me. Specifically, the Pizza Hut promotion.
Yes. So I think for a lot of people, the Sentinels were their first X-Men villain.
Yep,
again,
definitely.
Even more so than Magneto. They chose with that cartoon, which I argue to this day was ahead of its time. And it's what got me into comics.
Absolutely.
What got me into comics. It's goofy. There are things about it, like the fact they can't punch each other or shoot each other. Like there's stuff going on where there was restrictions from Fox that literally like they couldn't show explicit violence. So if you go back and look, it's a lot of like lasers that miss things.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the hallmark of the X-Men animated series. But the stuff they were doing on a children's Saturday morning cartoon, touching on racism, discrimination, and all of that, just even the theme song, man, it's ahead of its time.
Oh.
And there is a reason why the Sentinels are the first villains they use.
Absolutely.
Because they go right for the metaphor.
Absolutely.
And this story back in 1965, as much as the 90s series was ahead of its time, this 1965 story was ahead of its time. And like you said, you guys pointed out, the scenes with, you know, Warren trying to hide that he's a mute, the scenes with the cab driver turning against Scott Summers, the scenes with these people, like, just suddenly this society that 14 issues ago were lauding the X-Men for saving Cape Citadel from Magneto
mm-hmm.
have suddenly turned on mutants because they are different.
Right.
And just think of, like, I don't know, man. I just get fired up talking about this stuff because this is my favorite stuff in comics. But think of the guts it had to take for Stan Lee, a middle-aged white guy, to be writing this stuff. To be saying, like, this is important enough that we need to touch upon it. Like, just the social awareness that he had. And, you know, at the end of the day, you can argue, well, was he doing it to sell comics? Yes, of course. But I do think there was some degree of him being, I want to comment on stuff that's going on in society. and just the sheer power and bravura of these issues that introduced the Sentinels. And I guess we've talked around the Sentinels without actually saying what they are, but basically they're giant robots built by this guy, Bolivar Trask, to track down and exterminate mutants, mm-hmm. because mutants are the next step in human evolution, and as a result, humans are terrified of them. But I've said a lot. Let me give you your chance at the podium to kind of touch upon stuff you might not have in the initial Marvel Age episode.
No, I mean, like I said, you're right. I mean, the choice of the Sentinels to kick off X-Men the Animated Series was a brilliant move because, like you said, it gets straight to the allegory, it gets straight to the metaphor. Yep. It dives
allegory.
It dives right into the heart of what the X-Men are when they're at their best. And so, I know, me as a kid, it left a huge imprint on me. I can still, like, vividly see that scene of, you know, the Sentinels bursting through the shopping mall and coming after Jubilee. Sure. Like, that's one of my first X-Men memories. And so it was really cool to get to go back and see how they were introduced here. You know, the designs wasn't quite there yet. They were a little smaller. They weren't quite the hulking masses that we had come to know. And I was not aware that Master Mold was a concept that was introduced early on. Because I remember when Master Mold pops up on the animated series, I was like, oh, that's a big deal. And, like, here he is, you know, right from the jump. So,
Again, you're seeing something with Stan and his artistic collaborators on this. It was Alex Toth on the Juggernaut issues, and then it's Werner Roth on these issues. I'm pretty sure.
Back on the layouts, and Jay Gavin, it says, on the inking.
Interesting. Okay, I have no idea who that is. I don't know if that's a super.
Jay Gavin and Vince Coletta.
Vince Coletta, I know. Okay. But Jay Gavin, not. This was just like, from the start, Stan, and, you know, like, let's not run over the fact that Jack may have still had some input at this point, because he is still working on the book, but whoever's inputting it, just the Sentinels were fully formed. They were not some of these characters we've talked about, Daredevil being one we've talked about on this very episode, who kind of, they had the broad strokes, and they would, later writers would fill in the rest. Mm-hmm. No, the Sentinels that we saw years later in Days of Future Past, or years later on X-Men the Animated Series, or years later in the X-Men movies, like, these guys came fully formed. And what I love that you guys talked about is the fact that Stan didn't wait to have them turn on humanity either, because he had this great idea and he wanted to get every last bit of it into these three issues, because who knew how long he would be writing X-Men, who knew if he would get a chance to do a second Sentinel story. So he packs it all right into this first Sentinel story, and it really changes everything, because it changes everything for the X-Men. Now, something we're going to have to look at in the next few years is, why was it not enough to sustain the X-Men? Because the X-Men will eventually go away for an extended period of time. But this is groundbreaking stuff, and I think it absolutely blows the narrative you discussed out of the water in terms of, you know, the X-Men weren't what the X-Men were until 1975. No. In 1965, this was there, and the first Sentinel story really was a game-changing story.
I mean, yeah, it totally was. So it was, like I said, it was just so cool to go back and get in on this concept at the ground floor, because when I think of the X-Men, I think the Sentinels, Magneto and Sentinels are the first two villains that pop in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And it continues the trend of, as we've been doing this reread and kind of rediscovery of the Marvel Universe for some of us, Spider-Man and Fantastic Four are the books that I knew were good. Journey into Mystery is the one that's just kind of a treat because it's not as widely celebrated. But then, to me, X-Men is the one that's really, like, been the pleasant surprise.
Yeah.
Maybe along with Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
But X-Men, to a large extent, I was just like, I've always been an X-Men fan. They've always been my favorite comic, in part because of those cartoons. And just getting to see the origins of these concepts and how X-Men really was a better comic than people give it credit for. I think, again, the narrative that you spoke to. A lot of people buy into that idea that X-Men didn't get good until the mid-70s, and that's just not the case.
Yeah, I mean, for me, as something of an X-Men novice, like, I've read, you know, very little X-Men in terms of the big, like, Chris Claremont era stuff that is held up as the greatest example of the book.
Right.
That's always been, you know, if I ask someone, all right, so tell me about the X-Men, and everybody goes, well, it kind of all started with Giant Size X-Men number one. I've heard that line so many times from people over the years, or read it different places. And, you know, going through this project has just reinforced to me and exposed the fact that that is not the case. Like, the X-Men, Stan and Jack had this concept nailed down. Probably, like you said, more so Stan, because Jack is starting to back away from the book at this point a little bit.
Right.
But the foundation for the X-Men stories that would come later is being laid by Stan. It's a lot. The building blocks are there much more prominently than people would have you believe.
I think it's going to be very interesting that you, in your position as an X-Men novice, to see how you receive the Claremont stuff when we get there eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Because kind of the beauty of this Stan stuff is it's pretty timeless. Like, it still works. Obviously, there are elements of it that are goofy in Silver Age, but I think one of the big knocks on the Claremont X-Men, and, you know, if you love the Claremont X-Men, you love the Claremont X-Men. I'm in that camp. I love the Claremont X-Men. But there is a knock that Claremont has a style that's very immediately dated.
Mm-hmm.
So I will be curious to see how we do when we get there, what you think of that. But that is in the future. This is now in the past, this episode, because we're done. We've covered all of 1965, part one.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of this, Nick, is that I get you back for another episode when we cover part two of 1965, and I'm very much looking forward to that. I really enjoyed having you on tonight. This was awesome.
Yep.
And where can people find you all around the interwebs and whatnot?
Yeah, so on Twitter, I'm at NickDuke87, currently retweeting tons of comic stuff and in my countdown to football season, so that'll be annoying for new followers.
Was that because you were born in 87?
I was born in 87, yep.
All right, continue.
I was born in 87, the greatest year, when the year of our Lord, when Hulk Hogan body slammed Andre the Giant. So
You were born the minute Hogan slammed Andre, you were
conceived. I was born 9 months. Yeah. 9 months later. There you go.
Yeah, 9 months later. That slam. Those are your parents. Right?
But anyway, on Facebook, you can also find me. I'm always around the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. We got lots of good stuff going on over there. The Brad Learns Comics thread, which has just become an entity unto itself. It's incredible to see how that thing is still going. So yeah, you can find me over there, and of course here on Place to Be Nation Pop. Listen to Marvel Age, which I am, I guess, technically the host of. And then also the co-host of, as has been mentioned, Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are weekly,
which I believe is the longest running weekly episodic podcast.
Comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. Yes, that is
I said longest running podcast in Place to Be Nation comics.
Oh, see.
Which would be the same thing as comic podcast in Place to Be Nation pop. So we're both right.
Yeah, there you go. We just don't have the trademark on that other one. So we got to keep it in brand.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, so we're that's a weekly podcast as we made reference to, and so month of July, keep an eye out for. We are going to be celebrating the 10th anniversary of the release of Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, with an entire month of shows themed around the Dark Knight trilogy.
Crazy. 10 years, man. Wow. Yep. All right. If you guys want to find me, you can find me on Twitter at Ben J. Morse. You can find me on Instagram at Ben Morse. That's Morse like Morse code 882, because that's the year I was born. On Facebook, I'm in the same place that Nick is, Place to Be Nation Comics. I have not touched that Brad thread because I'm terrified of it, but maybe I'll try to wade in and give my opinion. And of course, you know, I'll keep plugging it until it's years later. If you guys want to experience my TED Talk, in which I discuss a lot of the same stuff we talked about here tonight as far as X-Men, and also talked about Spider-Man, Ms. Marvel, and a bunch of other stuff, you can watch my TED Talk at unlvtv.unlv.edu/TEDxUNLV. Start the video at 1 hour and 17 minutes, but also go back and listen to all those other guys. They were great, too. But yeah, man, let's end it there because we got a lot more to talk about in 65. We're not nearly done with this, and I can't wait to hear you guys cover the rest of 65, and then you will come back here, and we will cover the rest of 65.
Can't wait, man. Sounds like a plan.
All right, guys. Until next time, blast dismissed.
Consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We'll